Welcome to the Sunday night There Is a Solution newcomer and returning members meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. Visit our website at oaontario.org, where you'll find this audio recording, additional podcasts, and a place to donate to keep this special service active. The opinions expressed are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. Our speaker tonight is a compulsive overeater and a member who has at least 6 months of abstinence, has recovered through the directions in the Big Book, and maintains recovery on a daily basis. After the share, there will be time to make a comment or ask a question about the OA program or what the speaker has shared. Welcome, Amy G., a compulsive overeater from Maryland. Welcome.
Should I go ahead? Awesome. Hi, everyone. My name is Amy G. I am a recovered compulsive overeater from Maryland, and I am so grateful to be here. Just real quick, I think it was Kathleen who was going to be my timer. So just shout out because I keep it on the squares. So it just makes it easier. And feel free to interrupt me. It's not a problem at all. So greatly appreciate it. I always say I'll never take all that time. And before you know it, so I appreciate the time, the reminders, greatly appreciate it so that I don't have to worry about it. So, like I said, my name is Amy G. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater from Maryland. And it is an honor and a privilege to be here and to share my story of, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, my experience, strength, and hope. And I understand this is also a meeting of newcomers and a meeting of people returning as well. And, I love slogans and sayings in Overeaters Anonymous. You're going to hear a lot of them tonight. But, to the newcomer, I say, welcome to Overeaters Anonymous. Welcome home. As the tradition says, the only requirement for membership is a desire to not be crazy with food. So we are so grateful you're here and we welcome you. And for those that are returning, there's another saying I love, and of course, in OA, we say, keep coming back. It works if you work it. But there's also another saying that says, don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle, keep coming back. And I'm so glad that you're here because my story has me filly farting with OA for almost 5 years before I truly surrendered to this program, put the food down, and started working the steps the way that it's outlined in the Big Book. So, God bless you all and this fellowship, as they say, God with skin on, because you told me to keep coming back. You never judged me. You never criticized me. You showed me love and tolerance. You showed me love when I could not do it for myself. And for that, the fellowship is invaluable. You showed me hope. I had never had hope before, but in this program, there is always hope. So don't walk out 5 minutes before the miracle. Keep coming back. Just to qualify, since you can only see me from the shoulders up, so to speak, I came to OA in March of 1983, and then I did not become recovered until December of 87. So that's almost 5 years. And when I say recovered, it's the definition of OA's abstinence and recovery. I didn't make it up. It's refraining from compulsive eating and compulsive food behaviors while working towards or maintaining a healthy body weight. And I'm grateful to say that I've had that for a little over 36 years now. My abstinence recovery date is December 7th. In the States, that's Pearl Harbor Day. I always joke around that the ships were sunk, and so was I when it came to this disease. They say that this disease has three Ds: denial, delusion, and defiance. And I had it in spades and active addiction. And then when you're dying, desperate, and doomed, you're finally ready. The other three Ds of the disease, you're finally ready for recovery. And that's where I was in December of 87. I will tell you, though, I had a lot of hell before that. Torturous, compulsive, and torturous binging and purging. I'm also recovering bulimic and anorexic. I'm also a recovered drug addict and alcoholic. I mean, if you can catch my drift here, if it could anesthetize me in any way, shape, or form, I wanted it, and I wanted more of it. They call this a disease of more. My top weight was 170, but with that denial, delusion, and defiance, I just stopped getting on the scale. So I probably put on another 20 or so, so pushing 200. I've also been anorexic. I did that in Overeaters Anonymous. Some of us are overachievers. And that weight was 102. I had people in the fellowship saying, Amy, you know, what's going on? So I wouldn't listen. And then I stopped going to meetings and I got very, very ill, very, very ill. And then it was like the switch was flipped and I started eating and binging and purging. I'm also recovered bulimic. So 102, pushing 200, the extremes, and then the bulimia. I mean, I am a, you know, living underneath the bridge, bottle in the bag, underneath, you know, living the life of an alcoholic underneath the bridge kind of compulsive eater. I'm a food addict, really. That's what I am. And when it came to the heights of my bulimia, I was binging and purging around the clock. This disease is so cunning and so baffling. It talks to you in your own language, right? It gets up in your head and wants to isolate you and kill you. It wants to tell you that it's okay. You got it. Just use a little more willpower. You can diet on Monday. Don't worry about it. My family's motto is all it takes is a little willpower. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You can do anything you put your mind to. So I just needed another diet. I just needed this or that. And when I had a friend say, hey, I got the magic trick. Just stick your finger down your throat and then you can eat whatever you want and not get fat. And I was like, wow, because to me, I mean, I didn't care what I was doing to myself in private. You know, I wanted to be thin. I thought thin was well, but I also wanted to eat whatever I wanted. So to me, that was like the dream. I always joke around that if I had a genie in a bottle and three wishes, it would be eat whatever I want, not get fat. Second wish, eat whatever I want, not get fat. Third wish, eat whatever I want, not get fat, right? Because that was the dream. That was the length of my maturity at that time in my teens and early 20s, right? Because I thought that thin was well. I bought the myth that the world sells you that somehow if you meet the magic numbers on the scale that your life is going to come together like a freaking fairy tale. And I couldn't understand why that wouldn't work for me, why I couldn't stay on a diet. And, you know, that purging was just a way to try to cope. And what started as a mechanism to just, you know, well, let me put it this way. When I used to binge before, I would eat until I couldn't get like another bite in. And then I would pass out on the couch. But with the purging, it just came away to then purge and then keep on binging. So my binges went from, you know, a few hours to 24 hours to 42, you know, to 72 hours. To where I was a freshman in college, binging and purging for entire weekends. And I don't say this to gross you guys out, but it's just a reminder of the devastation of this disease. What I was doing in March of 83 was I was in college and I was in a dorm and my roommate would go home every weekend to see her boyfriend. And I would take a large trash can and I would put a green leafy trash bag inside of it. And I would binge and purge in that trash can all weekend in my dorm room. And then I'd leave in the middle of the night and, you know, go out for the larger trash bins and then throw the big bag in there. And I'll never forget one day when one evening when I went out there, I went to throw the bag of vomit into the big trash bin and I missed and it splattered all over the street and all over the ground. And of course, there was nothing I could do. So the next morning when it was found, the counselors went and knocked door to door and they were like, well, they were saying like, you know, knocking on the door going, hey, are you the bulimic? Like anyone was going to go, yeah, that was me. But I'll never forget. They knocked on the door and I could feel the shame. I could feel the self-hatred rise from my toes into my face. And I thought for sure they would know it's me. And of course they asked me and I said, no. And when they shut the door, I turned to the bed frame and I punched the bed frame in self-hatred and frustration. And I broke the knuckles in my hand. I've done it a couple times, actually. I looked in the mirror and I punched the mirror and I had to have stitches put in my hand because I thought that there was something wrong with me. You know, I don't know about you all, but when you were a kid, did you walk around like I did when and compare yourself to everyone else and kind of like wonder how did they get the instruction manual to life and somehow I missed it? You know, they call this a disease. It's really a dis-ease living in your own skin. And I couldn't live in my own skin comfortably. The big book in the doctor's opinion talks very clearly about why it is that we eat or drink. Because we have a twofold illness, a physical allergy and a mental obsession. And why do we crave the foods we do? Because we get restless, irritable, and discontent, the RIDS, right? And we can only feel better when we get a sense of ease and comfort that comes at once from taking a drink or a bite. And that's what happened to me. I tried to create my own instruction manual for life, right, on self-centeredness and selfishness and self-will run riot. And I stepped on the toes of my fellows. Life didn't go the way I wanted it to. And I was so uncomfortable living in my own skin that I sought ease and comfort that food gave me. I didn't know I was dealing also with an allergy, that when I put sugar, high fat, flour, and volume, that was a big one to wrap my brain around. Because a volume would trigger me and I would wind up in the sugar and high fat. I mean, I could binge on carrots, right? I turned my hands orange from eating so many carrots, right? They call it carotenitis or something like that, you know, but I would always wind up in my binge foods. That was my allergy, a phenomenon of craving for more of my binge foods that had sugar, high fat, flour, and volume. And when I put those substances into my body, I create the phenomenon of craving for more, and I cannot stop. Like an alcoholic, I cannot stop. But if I knew that was the problem, which I did, once I came to Overeaters Anonymous in March of 83, right? They told me you're a compulsive overeater, or you decide whether you're a compulsive overeater. I knew that sugar was killing me. I knew as soon as I put a candy bar in my mouth, I never knew when I was going to stop, right? So I knew that, and I was willing to admit that. Step one, right? It is a we program. We admit we're powerless, but I have to say there's only one thing me, myself, and I can do, and that's to admit I'm powerless and who and what I am. So I was willing to admit that I was powerless. I was willing to admit that I needed to refrain from those foods because once I started eating them, that I would be crazy like an alcoholic and couldn't stop. So if I knew all of that, and I was willing to admit to my step one, why is it that I still found myself for almost 5 years in and out of Overeaters Anonymous, standing in front of the refrigerator, five bites into a binge going, how the hell did I get here? With everything that I knew in OA, with everything that I learned, and even admitting powerlessness, why? And that's what we call the mental obsession, the greater aspect of this disease. The Doc Ops says it's a mental twist, a mental obsession. It's why I need to be working this program the way I've worked it from day one in December of 87 to today. Right? There's a saying in AA that we come for our drinking, but we stay for our thinking, right? You know, that instruction manual that I made up on my own? Well, through my step work, I came to realize that my selfish, self-centered, and controlling behavior was not going to allow me to live life in a sane and sober manner. And if I didn't change, the big book talks about a personality change sufficient to bring about recovery, that if I didn't change, that I would not stay abstinent. I would not stay sober, right? Because I could stay stopped a bazillion times and I did it in OA, but I could never stay stopped because the food would always eventually come calling. I hadn't been returned to sanity that step two talks about. So finally in December of 87, and again, God bless his fellowship and the slew of sponsors that I went through who never watered down the program. And they kept saying, Amy, keep coming back. Finally, I had a what they call, I guess, a tough love sponsor. And to me, I believe that's what my higher power needed to give me at that time. And she said, Amy, if your way is working so well, why are you here? Right. And I couldn't debate with that any. And I couldn't debate with that anymore. And I was finally willing to surrender to what this program had to offer. And I was willing to believe in whom the problem had been solved, you all, the recovered people, my sponsor, and follow direction. She said, Amy, in Overeaters Anonymous, we don't think our way into a new way of acting and believing. We act our way. As a matter of fact, I'm going to ask you to act as if. And eventually, you're going to start thinking in a sane manner. But the goal is to put the food down, work these steps so that you have a power greater than yourself that will restore you to sanity so that one, the food doesn't call, and two, you're equipped with a new instruction manual, if you will, to live life. And boy, did I have a lot of growing up to do because I was 22 at that time. And I was living at home and I was unemployed and I needed to learn how to get out there and be a grown up. I'll be real honest with you. I struggled a lot in that early recovery with agnosticism. Like I said, my family's motto was all it takes is a little willpower. And I struggled with this idea of a Zeus-like character that was going to zap me in the butt every time I did something wrong. And my sponsor was like, look, we're going to fire that higher power and we're going to allow a new one to evolve as you start working these steps. And she said, I don't care if you think it's Jesus, Buddha, or the universal vibes of a tree, as long as it isn't you and it's greater than you. And you know what? That was okay with me at that time because I knew that left to my own thinking, even with willpower and knowledge and experience, left to my own thinking that in actuality, my thinking was a liability, right? That left to my own devices, I would come up with some insane excuse to rationalize that it would be okay to put my binge foods down my mouth. And oh yes, that somehow it would be sane to then stick my finger down my throat, right? Or exercise 6 hours a day on a treadmill or something to work off that pint of ice cream or those dozen of cookies. You know, I didn't want to live that insane way of life anymore. So I was willing to surrender and I was willing to take action and I was willing to stop thinking. I was willing to just do. And so at first, the higher power was just you all, the power of Overeaters Anonymous and those who have gone before me, right? And then as we began to work step 4 through 7, you know, I was willing to turn my will and my life over to you guys, to something out there, and then just get down to the business of figuring out what was going on inside me. They talk about it a lot in AA. They go alcoholism, the ism, right? The inside me stuff. And what I learned was that I was a very young, immature, very selfish, self-will run riot, like I said, young woman who didn't have a clue on how to deal with life without anesthetizing herself with one crutch or another. And it was a very scary place to be. But slowly but surely, through this inventory work, you know, at first I was really scared about it. And then as I began to understand myself and figure out what was going on, it became incredibly empowering and incredibly freeing to understand this was why I did the things I did. This is why I act the way I do. Do I like it? You know what I mean? No. You know, another thing that held me back in my first number of years in OA was not only inventory work, but also the amends, right? Like I treated this program kind of like buffet style, if you'll excuse the pun. I'll have a little of this step, a little of that step. And oh yeah, step 9, when hell freezes over on some of those amends, ain't never gonna happen, people. But finally, as I started to begin the sequential process of working these steps and going through the inventory, I started to realize that I also played my part and I became willing to make amends. Now, there were some amends that I played no part, but I had to be willing to forgive and move on, because what happened was, as I was living in amends where I had been hurt, and I took that hurt and continued to hurt myself. I mean, this was some deep shit, people, that I had to learn about why I acted the way I do. And thank God for this program and the fellowship and the network of women that I developed as I talked to them on the phone, as we went through this process of steps with my sponsor, to understand, one, I was not alone. Two, I wasn't the only crazy person in the room. And three, there wasn't anything that I hadn't gone through that someone else had not gone through. If I was humble and willing enough to ask for help or tell them what my experience was, and just, it was like so incredible how higher power worked. You know, that's when my higher power started to evolve, because the person would say to me, you know, I went through that and this is how I got through it. Or I empathize, right? It also says in the program, we're only as sick as our secrets. I mean, there were some things that I thought I would never tell anyone about. And I became freer and freer as I began this process of making amends, of doing a fifth step. You know, this whole process, did I do it perfectly? I mean, absolutely not. But my life started to change. You know, there's a great quote in the fourth edition in one of the stories. It's not in the first 164. And I always say, please don't slap me for it. But there really are some wonderful sayings, you know, that come from the stories, right? And one of them is on page 316 in the fourth edition. It says, my chance to live. And this describes my early sobriety and abstinence to a T. Sobriety is nothing like I thought it would be. At first, it was one big emotional roller coaster full of sharp highs and deep lows. My emotions were new, untested, and I wasn't entirely certain I wanted to deal with them. I cried when I should have been laughing. I laughed when I should have cried. Events I thought were the end of the world turned out to be gifts. It was all very confusing. Slowly, things began to even out. As I began to take the steps of recovery, my role in the pitiful condition of my life became clear. If asked what the two most important things in recovery are, I would have to say willingness and action. I was willing to believe that AA was telling me the truth. I wanted to believe it was true in a way I cannot relate in words. I wanted this thing to work, and then I began to take the course of action prescribed. And this is what we did together. You know, the saying in OA is, together we can do what we can never do alone. And this whole thing about the higher power, you know, it was amazing to me. My emotions, like that reading said, were like all over the map. You know, I remember pulling over on the side of the road and just like bawling my eyes out. And to this day, I have no idea what that was about. But I think it had something to do with the fact that I'd been anesthetizing my feelings for so long that when I was abstinent, I think they just came up and like the wires were all crossed, right? I didn't know what was up or down, but slowly things did start to even out, especially as I started to understand, you know, my character defects. And this whole higher power thing, when it came to amends, I mean, I think the reason why the promises are, you know, before we're halfway done through our amends, is because when I finally became willing to make some of those really hard amends, I saw things happen that I could not describe other than something greater than me aligning it so that it worked out the way it could, the way it did. You know, like I said, back then it was like, oh yeah, when hell freezes over. I'm talking about those amends when I finally became willing to see my part, or even if I had no part, right? I mean, I had some issues with sexual abuse, and I thought there is no way in hell. I didn't make amends to that person, but I made amends where I needed to for myself. And that's why we work with the sponsor very closely on our amends. We don't do this stuff alone, people. And I was actually guided for some where a sponsor was humble enough to say, you know, I don't have experience with this. You might want to check out a therapeutic environment for that. Big Book talks about that, that we are able to use our religion, to use outside sources if needed. I've learned that one of the most valuable sentences as a sponsor that I can say sometimes is, I don't know. Let me try to find out from others and get back to you, right? I'm not going to pretend I know about something that I don't. I'm not a marriage counselor. I'm not a therapist, but I can share my experience, strength, and hope, and my love, and guide accordingly. But anyways, I digress. What happened in those amends is I started to begin to believe in a power greater than myself. And the crazy thing about that is now, fast forward a couple of decades in the program, I now choose to call my higher power God. That is miraculous. If you had said to me at 22, Amy, you're going to call your higher power God, you're going to go back to your Christian faith, I would have said there, like, I would have bet you like a gazillion dollars, right, that it would never happen. And that's what's so amazing about this program. It not only saved my life from compulsive eating, I mean, that would have been enough for me to just not have the food call me 24/7, right? That has been true for me now for decades. The food does not call, thank God. But I've been given what they call in the Big Book a fourth dimension to life. You know, like we live in three dimensions, but a fourth is like kind of a dimension we don't really know. But I didn't realize that there was another way to live life, right? That wasn't all about me, myself, and I. It was about being of service to my fellows. It was about having a relationship with a higher power. I've been given so much more than just to not have the food call, right? And I could have never, ever imagined that. So I began to have this concept of God in my life. And now over the many decades I've been in this program, I live in steps 10, 11, and 12. And I live a very active, service-oriented program. I mean, I believe what it says in the Big Book. Sorry, I'm not great on pages, but it says, you know, our recovery is contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. So for me, is that 15?
Five minutes.
Oh, five. Oh, I missed the 15. Okay, great. So anyways, so for me, living in 10, 11, and 12, that accountability, you know, the saying in OA is that you can only coast downhill, or in the 12-step rooms, you can only coast downhill. So for me, an active program for myself is daily disciplines for my recovery, which is step zero, the food's got to be down. I need to know what my allergic substances are so that I'm not ingesting them. I've been an unabashed weigher and measurer because I need to know when my meal starts and stops to stop the obsession, right? Some people don't need that, but I do. I always joke around that, you know, depending on my emotional nature, I don't know 3 ounces from half a freaking cow, right? I don't know, like my full button is broken. I don't know, and I don't want to trigger the volume issue. So for me, I just weigh and measure and boom, I'm done. But the bottom line is that in Overeaters Anonymous, we need to have a line in the sand of what is abstinent and what is not, and what is, and to make sure that that food plan is free of any allergic substances, any of my binge foods, or as they say, my binge food ingredients, or they say my crack, there's no crack ingredients, you know, in my food plan, so that I'm free from the physical allergy. And then I can stay in 10, 11, and 12 and connected to that higher power. Because ultimately, I still can't fix me, y'all. That's not change, nor does it ever. I'm recovered, but I am not cured, right? So I need to have a step zero line in the sand of abstinence. And then I work my program, which means service. And it means also being connected to that higher power through prayer and meditation, accountability to my sponsor, accountability to my sponsees. So just to give you a quick example, my day, I get up in the morning, I get on my knees before I stand on my feet, because to me, that's about accountability and humility that I can't fix me about the food. And I ask for God to relieve me of the bondage of self, because frankly, through my step work, I realized that I can't relieve myself of my character defects any more than I could with the food. So I ask God to relieve me of the bondage of self. And then I go on and I go about my day. I do my prayer and meditation in the morning. I have devotionals. I read some type of program literature, usually in the big book and the AA 12 and 12. I mean, this is my fourth edition. You should see my third edition. I've rebound that one. My 12 and 12 is falling apart. That's okay because I read this like a textbook. That's what this is for me. And it's amazing to me how many times I read this and I go, wait a minute, I don't remember that being in there the last time I read it. It's kind of funny how God puts in there exactly what I need to read because I do study this book still on a regular basis. I take my sponsee calls, right? I do 10 steps as necessary because just because I've been around for a while doesn't mean that I don't act out in crazy ways sometimes. And, you know, the beauty of this program and why I say recovered, not cured, is that it seems like nowadays I have a choice, right? I may want to act insane, or say, for example, I may want to pitch my husband out the window because he didn't do what I wanted him to do, right? But that's just the thought, right? That's the part of me that's not recovered. But the important thing is what I do with the second thought and then the action thereafter, right? So the second thought would be something like, yeah, Amy, there you go again. He's not following your script. This is about you, not about him. And then I keep my mouth shut and not say what I'm supposed to say now, or what I wanted to say. Let's put it that way, right? Those are things that I do. Or for example, if it doesn't go quite that well, I need to make a 10 step. I need to make an amends. So I'm actively working those steps. You know, to me, step 11 in that prayer and meditation, one of the hardest things for me to do because I'm impulsive, I'm compulsive by nature, you know, I don't want to sit still. Very hard for me to do. So for me, an active meditation program is vital for me to actually sit still and go, you know, and chill. And that's really hard. I have struggled with that on and off for decades. But all I can say is I try to do the best that I can. It's a program of progress, not perfection, right? And then, of course, I'm of service. And that's really, really important. The big book talks about it in working with others. If nothing ensures immunity. Thank you. I'll wrap it up with just a couple more things here. That nothing ensures immunity than working with another compulsive overeater. So for me, sponsorship in my program is not optional. I must be sponsoring. If I'm recovered, I've worked the 12 steps, I must be sponsoring because I need to carry a message of depth and weight. I mean, yes, I can do a lot of other service things, but I need to be sponsoring so that I can stay green and grateful. I sponsor for myself, right? Because I know it will help me, but I also sponsor to give back what I've so generously been giving. And so I'm just going to wrap up with this is just to say, you know, I can't jam 36 years in here. I tried to give you a little bit about what it's like to live in 10, 11, and 12. But I will tell you one of my favorite quotes in the big book is page 17 in the chapter, There Is a Solution. And I want the newcomer to hear this especially, or the returnee. It says, we have a common solution upon which we can join in brotherly, harmonious action, right? Where it's a common solution. There's no secret code. It's one day at a time, putting the food down and working the 12 steps. I'm not all that. I'm just another bozo on the bus, the recovery bus, if you will. If I can do it, you can do it. It's just this program. It's just these 12 steps. And it allows us to have access to power that we do not have. Power that allows us to recover so that the food doesn't call, and power to live life in a sane and sober way, even when tragedy strikes and when things don't follow our script, right? So my last quote is from the chapter, Me, an Alcoholic, the story. And it says here on page 386, here I found an ingredient that had been lacking in any other effort I had made to save myself. Here was power. Here was power to live to the end of any given day, power to have the courage to face the next day, power to have friends, power to help people, power to stay sane, power to stay sober. Moreover, I am deeply convinced that so long as I continue to strive in my bumbling way toward the principles I first encountered in earlier chapters of this book, This remarkable power will continue to flow through me. What is this power? With my AA and my OA friends, all I can say is that it is a power greater than myself. Thank you so much for allowing me to share. It is always an honor and a privilege. And with that, I will pass.
Thank you so much, Amy, for sharing your experience, strength, and hope.